Thank you, Slim. My name is Joe Coulter, and I'm a very grateful alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I am grateful. I just came in this afternoon, and I'm going tomorrow, and it occurs to me to be a little self-conscious about that because I just moved. I made one of the moves that we all make in the ministry every now and then when we accept a call, you know. Every time I hear the word call, I think of the cartoon I saw in New Yorker years ago. These two fellows were sitting around with their collars on, and one of them says, I got a call to Pittsburgh last week, $13,000 a year, you know. Well, I just answered a call, and I've got a lot of feelings. I moved in January, 1st of January, and the reason I have to go back tomorrow is it's too early for those people to find out they can do without me. So I am going back tomorrow, but this is where I need to be right now. I have no doubt about that at all. In fact, there's very few things that have happened to me the last while, since I've been in AA, that have done anything but convince me that God is involved in my life as he is in yours. And this is a tremendous, tremendous relief to me. It's a tremendous relief. So I'm sort of like the little old lady at the protracted meeting. You all know what a protracted meeting is. The Methodists have them. They go up in the mountains, you know, these places where they've got a captive audience. They can't get out. And instead of having a week-long revival, they'll have 4 or 5 weeks. And this fellow had been up there, and it was the last night of the protracted meeting. And he'd set this night aside for people to give their personal witness. And he'd lined up a few because he didn't want it to be a complete bust, you know. But there was a little old lady that had been to every meeting. She had been to everyone, and she had sat right down in the front pew. I noticed nobody sitting in the front pew. She had sat right down in the front pew every night, she and her teenage son. And he kept hoping this little lady would come up and share her experience with the rest of them, and he didn't want to embarrass her by asking her, and he prayed that she'd come, but she just didn't come. And finally, he couldn't stand it any longer. He said, "Won't you come up and share with us what these meetings have meant to you?" And she was all flustered, you know, and she stood up and all embarrassed. She said, "No, Pastor," says, "I'm just full up to here." So she sat down, and he turned to her son. He said, "Son, maybe you could come up and speak for your mother and yourself." He said, "No, sir, I'm just like Mama. I've got a belly full of you, too." You know? I'm full tonight, like that little old lady, and I need to be here because I can sort out a lot of that fullness and recognize it for what it is and what it should be, and it's gratitude. It's gratitude to you, to this program, and God working through you in this program, which have given me everything that I have, and I am indeed grateful for it. And I don't know, Howard, surely, I don't know if y'all have all heard my joke or not, but it's what I tell occasionally. There's not but one way I know to tell a story, and that's straight at it, you know. There is a story of an old bachelor who never been anywhere in his life, and he won a trip to Europe. And he wanted to go, really. He'd never been anywhere, and it was a free trip, but he decided, no, he wasn't going. He couldn't leave his cat. He had an old cat, Maggie, been with him. He lived right there with him, you know, and he just couldn't go off and leave Maggie, and she'd miss him. And his sister told him, said, John, now you go on. Says, now that's silly. Just stay home for that cat. Says, bring the cat over and let her stay with me and Mama. And you go on and have a good time. So he decided he would, and he was a little reluctant, but he went. But he couldn't wait. His first stop was London, and he couldn't wait to get to a phone and call back to see how Maggie was. So he did. He got to the telephone. He got his sister on the phone, says, how's Maggie? And she said, the damn cat's dead. You know, just wiped him out. Just. And he said, you told me you were going to take care of Maggie. Now, what happened? She said, well, the damn cat's dead. That's all. Says, she got out, I guess, looking for you or something, and a car ran over and killed her, and she's dead. Well, he's hurt, you know. And he finally got himself collected. Lily said, well, you could have broken the news a little easier. She said, how could I have broken the news? Said, the cat's dead, and I've told you. He said, well, you know how much Maggie meant to me. Says, you could have said something like tonight. You could have said that Maggie climbed out on the roof, and you had to get the fire department to come and get her, and she, you know, you've ruined my vacation. He said, then tomorrow night, or when I called back, you could have said that Maggie had caught pneumonia out there, and maybe the next time I called, you could have said that Maggie expired. You didn't have to just say the damn cat dead, you know. So she apologized, and, you know, she had been a little direct about it. And he decided to go on with his vacation, and a few days later he was in Geneva, and he called back again, and he got his sister on the phone, and he says, how is everything? And she said, fine. Everything's fine. Says, last night, Mama climbed out on the roof. Yeah. I don't know any roof climbing ways to tell my story. I'm an alcoholic. And I can say now something that I couldn't understand when I first came into this program. I am glad that I'm an alcoholic. I am deeply grateful that I went through the hell of alcoholic drinking, if that's what it took for me to find the relationship with God and with you people that I found since coming into this program. I'm an orphan. I was born up in western North Carolina, a town called Statesville. And my parents died when I was a year old, and I was shifted around. I mention this because I think it has some bearing. I start at the very beginning. I shifted around. I have an older brother, and the two of us were kept together. This was during the Depression, and we shifted around from, you know, one aunt to another to another. I guess they were all afraid they'd have to raise us if they kept us too long, and so we didn't stay in any one place very long. And finally, when I was almost five and my brother was eight, we ended up down in eastern North Carolina, where we came to the attention of a family who had no children, a family named Matthews. And I mentioned their name because I guess by all rights my name should be Matthews. We were never legally adopted, but these folks took us and made us their sons. I know now, I suppose my needs at that time were so complex that it took me a while to know this, but they made us their sons as completely as they knew how. My daddy was a Dubai, and I refer to him naturally, I think, as my daddy. He was a tobacco farmer, and when they took us, he bought more land. He was already figuring how he was going to divide it up, you know, between my brother and me. And And he told me he's dead now, but he told me that he knew a long time ago that neither one of us would ever be farmers. But I tell people that I owe my education to tobacco. And they assume that I mean that tobacco paid for it, which it probably helped, but I say, no, I always knew if I didn't get one, I'd be working in the damn stuff all my life, you know? But I was brought up on a tobacco farm down in eastern North Carolina. That's up in eastern North Carolina from here, isn't it, Harry? I'm not used to being down here, you see. I mention all this because I'm aware now, and this is a recent awareness for me. I don't recall a single conscious time when I was not thinking in terms of leaving. I read a book. I've read several books since I've been sober. One of the books I've read since I've been sober was a little book by a Roman Catholic priest named Powell called Why Am I Afraid to Tell You Who I Am? In which he makes the observation that we don't have any hidden selves lurking around inside of us to be discovered. Rather, we are what we're committed to. You think about that. We are what we're committed to. I don't suppose I was ever committed to anything in my early years. I don't think I ever felt a part of the family that adopted me. I know I'd never felt a part of the community in which I lived. I was very conscious of the fact that they were all the rest of them were related to each other. You know how that is. And I wasn't one of them. I've been in the habit since childhood of, my name was not familiar in the area where I grew up. So I've always been in the habit of spelling it. People. People ask me my name, I give them my last name and spell it because it's not familiar. I always knew I was going to leave, and for me, education was the way in which I saw my out. You know, I always knew that I was going to college. I always knew that I was going to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and I was going to amount to something, you know. I'm told that that's not uncommon for alcoholics. to believe that they're going to amount to something important, and I always believed that I was. I was a fairly good student in public school, and I always knew that I was going to amount to something important. And I was going to college, and this was the way out. You see, I was always thinking of leaving, and so I dropped out of high school, you know, which is may be typical too, I don't know. At 15, I left home and went into the service. And I stayed in about a year and a half, went to Germany, and I came back, and sure enough, I went to the University of North Carolina. I found out some years later that I dropped out of my high school class, but I was the only member of it to finish college. And I went to a little county high school. And I've looked at that with some pride since then. Now, I was brought up, and I'll get this together, I hope. I was brought up in a good home. Now, I've heard people say that they were brought up in a good Christian home, and I'm here to tell you I don't believe I know, at least for sure, just what they're talking about. Or at least I don't know what they mean as far as I'm concerned. I was brought up in a family that went to church. But as I look back on my church experience, my religious experience, it was a Sunday sort of a thing. And my mother's still living. She was 80 years old the last day of January, my foster mother. And she's still a Baptist. And I used to go home, if I'd been working, I'd have my collar around my neck, and I thought maybe she resented the fact that I was an Episcopalian. Because she'd say, son, take that thing off. You're not a preacher here. You know? And I thought she was resenting my being something besides the Baptist. But then I began to realize that I wasn't it at all. In my house, when the preacher was there, you act different. You know. That was all it was. She didn't want to act different with me there. And you know, if that was the way it is, I'm glad to take it off. But church was just sort of a Sunday thing with us. You know, it was a respectable thing to do. And we went to church and we saw people that we'd grown up with. But that was about it. I always knew that there was something going on. Now, alcohol was used in my family. My daddy used to take a drink first thing every morning. That was the only drink he took. He used to say one drink's enough for anybody. And one of his drinks was enough for most folks. He kept his liquor in a sideboard, old sideboard, I think belonged to my mother's grandfather. And he used to say he couldn't lie there after 5:30. You know, like he'd been lying there since 4:30, waiting for it to get 5:30 so he could get up and have a drink. But he'd get up at 5:30 in the morning, and he'd go and he'd pour himself about 5 or 6 ounces of that booze. And he didn't smoke, he wouldn't take any water or anything, but he'd just drink it down, and you could hear him. He'd wake up everybody else, he'd say, you know. Then he'd go for a walk. I don't know why. I learned at a very early age that alcohol was more than just any other beverage. I believe, to the best of my honest recollection, that it was associated primarily in my mind with festivity. After I became sober in AA, it was the first Christmas I dreaded, because even after I'd come into the church, it was hard for me to have any association of Christmas without some association there of liquor, of alcohol. I doubt seriously that any of us or anybody can look at a glass or a container of alcohol in the same way that we do at any other beverage. For example, I know I liked the taste of good bourbon whiskey. And I used to make much of this, but I like bourbon. I like the taste of bourbon. But I also like the taste of Coke. And a glass of Coke is enough. But I don't want a drink of bourbon. Never did, that I know of. So it's more than just a liquid. It had some glamour for me, and I think it came to have an aura of sophistication. You know, I was getting away from that tobacco farm. And I think it meant a great deal to me in that regard. At any rate, as I was growing up, I learned that, you know, drunks were bad, but by observation, a man, quote unquote, who can handle his liquor, was not bad for taking a drink. I learned that this was something men did. They usually went to the kitchen to do it, but men had drinks of liquor. Well, I went away to the service, as I said, when I was 15 years old, and I took a little experiment when I was in Germany. I got drunk. I remember it very well. I used to remember it with a great deal of nostalgia. I got drunk off 15 cents, you know. I had two glasses of beer and a box of popcorn, each of which cost a nickel. And they had to carry me to my barracks, and I was sick as a dog. And I was young enough. I was enough of a neophyte as far as alcoholism was concerned that I had enough sense not to blame it on the popcorn. I knew what had made me sick. And for a long time, I was scared of it. I got back from Germany, as I said, and I finished up my high school work, and I went to the University of North Carolina, and I went like I was supposed to, like I'd always dreamed about going, the fraternity and all that. For a long time, I remembered that little experiment with beer in Germany. And I used to lie, you know, the reverse of the way I came to lie later. People talk about how much beer they drank, and I'd tell them I drank a whole lot more than I did. But I didn't want to get sick anymore, and I didn't. I remained a little afraid of alcohol for a long time. The Korean War came, and I went into the service again and was signed up in Washington, D.C. area. And it was a series of errors that got me there, but I believe it was the hand of God. You know, I look back on my life. I don't know if you can do this or not, but I look back on my life, and it seems to me that all the important events, the important turning points, were not accidental. I certainly, in my own decision making, could not have created the things that came to pass. When I look back on my life, I'm convinced that God was there. Whether I knew he was there or not, I'm convinced he was there. I was assigned up in Washington as an intelligence specialist, and that became a career. After I got out of the service and finished up my college work, I took a civilian appointment with the government as an intelligence specialist. And I worked very hard. I worked very hard getting away from that tobacco farm in eastern North Carolina. I progressed, and I became a self-made man. Y'all know what a self-made man is. That's somebody that makes it. Now, you know, if you don't make it, it's God's fault. But if you make it, you're a self-made man. I was a self-made man. And I was proud of myself. And my daddy was a Republican. He was a Universalist and a Republican, and that took courage in eastern North Carolina. And him being a Republican, I didn't dare tell him how much money I made. You know, I was afraid he'd write the president or something. Things were well. Now, as I progressed, you know, these things, all the accoutrements of my progression were very important to me. I didn't like being a tobacco farmer from eastern North Carolina, and I was getting as far away from it as I could. And so we served drinks. But to my knowledge, and as honest as I know how to be, I never had any problem. I never missed any work. I had a complete bar. I traveled in the Far East and got cheap booze, you know, but we never drank like some people did. Ann, my wife, never cared for it, really. So we never developed the habit of having a drink before dinner, you know, just the two of us. We never really opened the liquor cabinet unless somebody was coming. Now, there were times that I drank too much, but I don't remember ever a time of any blackouts or any of that sort. I know, however, that liquor meant a great deal to me, and I cannot honestly tell you right now if during this period in my life I could really have quit. Because I'm still trying to figure out what all liquor meant to me. It meant a whole hell of a lot more than a glass of Coke. It meant sophistication, and it meant a lot of things. And I doubt seriously that I could have quit. Of course, if anybody had suggested to me that I couldn't have quit drinking, I would have called them a liar pretty quickly. And when I had left home, I left the church. You know, looking back over this period, this was when I was 15. I left the church when I was 15, and it was a perfectly natural thing for me to do. As I said, the church was sort of a Sunday thing to us. I don't know how it was with you where you grew up, but that's the way it was with us. We went on Sunday. I went to Sunday school at the Baptist church with Aunt Lou and Aunt Vivi. Aunt Lou and Aunt Vivi used to come through the neighborhood and pick us all up and take us to Sunday school. And they were, the church didn't open unless they were there, I don't think. Cousin Hunter used to say he'd get drunk once in a while if you didn't watch him, you know. Cousin Hunter used to say, "Hell, when I die, I don't even want to go to heaven, because there won't be nobody there but Aunt Lou and Aunt Vivi, you know." I'm with Cousin Hunter, you know. Mark Twain, you know, said that heaven's no doubt got hell beat when it comes to climate, but for society he'd take hell any day. You know? And if you know, a lot of the folks that like Aunt Lou and Aunt Vivi, I'm sort of scared of them still. But anyway, we went to Sunday school and all that stuff. But when I left home, I left the church. It was, you know, I didn't know anybody at any other church, and it was just a natural thing for me to do at that point. Now, when I took my freshman philosophy course in college, you know, I started questioning some things, and by the time I was 20 years old, I was a highly educated and intelligent young man, and I was convinced I was an atheist. And I said so, and I was against the church. You know, I used to look forward to some preacher presuming to come to my door to ask me to go to church. I'd offer him a drink, you know. Most of them would leave. And I just didn't want anything to do with it. And we got married and had a little boy. He's a big boy now, as fine a young man as you'd ever want to see. But he was about, I don't know, I guess he was about 3 years old, and I thought that the best thing I could do for this boy would be to bring him up so that he could make his own choice freely. You know, so if he wanted to be a Buddhist, that would be all right with me, I said. You know, he could be a Jew, he could be a Christian, whatever he wanted to be, as long as he was free to choose what he wanted to be. And that's the way I was bringing him up, you know. And one Sunday morning, I had a little awakening out in the backyard, and one of the neighbors' little kids, we were living in the Maryland suburbs of Washington, and her parents were on the faculty at the university, and they were professed atheists, and had a real delightful little girl named Sheila. Real precocious girl, pretty. Sheila was out there in her jeans and all, and I was out puttering around, and on the other side of us was an Italian family. They were real devout members of the Roman church, and they had a couple little kids about Sheila's age, 5 or 6 years old, you know, and they were all dressed up. They'd just come in from Mass. And I overheard Sheila tell these other children, and it was just as defensive as hell. It was defensive. She says, "We don't believe in God." And that really, really hit me. I thought, my God, here's a six-year-old girl having to defend something that she shouldn't have to defend at 6 years old. She had to defend her family's position of atheism. So I went in and I told my wife, I said, "Hell, we're going to have to go to church." You know, and that's just about what I told her. And we did. We went to church, and I'm a director. You know, Oak Glen B in Greensboro, and that's where I came from before I went to Athens. And Glenn says we're directors. He remembers directing things when he's flat of his back on the dining room floor, you know. You wives don't remember any of that, do you? I was a director. I went in and announced to my wife that we were going to church, and I told her where. And I didn't find out till a year or two later that she didn't like my selection too much. But I had decided, and again, you know, I said a while ago that all these really important turning points don't seem to me to be accidental. by a series of circumstances that I won't begin to try to recount tonight, we ended up in probably the only church in which I would have stayed at that point in my life. It was as close to being a true Christian fellowship as I expect to see in this life. It was a whole lot like an AA group. It was a little Episcopal congregation in Maryland called St. Michael and All Angels Church. And we even had coffee after the services, you know, and folks would go around and they'd say, "How are you?" And you'd tell them, you know, kind of like we do. If you asked somebody how he was doing, he'd tell you. So you better be prepared to sit down and listen to him. We ministered to each other. And it was the most amazing thing that I'd ever seen, because I had this experience, and I'm grateful for it. I forgot it for a while. But I began to see that God was indeed operating in my life. And I became a Christian. Joined the church, and you know how we are, how we alcoholics are. I've heard folks say that, you know, he likes to come to AA meetings because that's where he finds out how intelligent all alcoholics are. You know, we at least know that. Excuse me. But I got involved. You know, it's all or nothing, it seems to be. And the next thing you know, I was on every committee. I was teaching Sunday school and on the vestry and working my job in the daytime and in the church at night. And before you know it, people are saying, "Why don't you go to seminary?" And my reaction to that was hell. You know, here I am. I've worked and I've gotten this nice job with the government, and I shouldn't give that up to go to seminary and be a preacher. But, you know, it wasn't long before I was saying, why not? Why not go to seminary? And I guess, really, in the back of my mind, there was a thought, well, I'd be a bishop in 5 or 10 years anyway. Why not go? And it really didn't matter. But I went. And I remember this very well. My rector, my priest, my clergyman at that church felt very strongly that I should go into the ministry. And I don't suppose I could have gone unless there had been people urging it, because it still, looking back, seems to be an audacious thing to do, to presume that the only way you can serve is in the front line, you know. But I remember very well the day I went to see the Bishop of Washington for an interview before going into seminary. I went down. His office was near the National Cathedral on what's called the Cathedral Close in Washington. And I purposely got there about an hour early. And I went down, I just walked through the cathedral, and if you've ever been in it, you know it's an inspiring place. And it's hard to put your finger on just why it is, but it is, or it is to me. And down in one of the little underground chapels, one of the basement chapels, there's several very pretty little chapels down there. I knelt for a long time that afternoon and asked God to help me be honest with the bishop and all the people that I'd be talking to, because I guess I was aware then of something of the trauma that I was about to go through. But I knew that I didn't need to go unless that was the place for me to be. I didn't need to be a minister unless this is what God wanted me to be. I had enough sense to know that. And I told him, I don't know that I was working a deal with God at that point, but what I told God was that if I could be honest, you know, not try to give people the answers I thought they wanted to hear, but just be honest, and they wanted me to be a minister, then I would take that as his call So I went through, and they did. They wanted me to go to seminary, and I figured, well, this is God's call. So I quit my job, sold everything we had, and we went to seminary. But this time, in addition to my son, we had a little baby girl. And we went to seminary. I sold the house and the car, both cars. A neighbor down the street gave me a 1953 Kaiser. I don't know what he was still doing with it, but he gave it to me, and that's the car I took to seminary. And I don't know, I was scared. The only way I know to tell you is up here in my mind, I figured, well, you know, everybody wants me to go to seminary. This is obviously what I should do. I've never seen a clergyman starve. Most of us are fat, you know. I've never seen anybody really hurting. This is what I'm supposed to do. Obviously, I'll do it. But the night before my first day at seminary, one of my going away presents had been a bottle of Beefeater's gin. And I drank most of that fifth of Beefeater's in gin and tonics that night right by myself. First time I ever remember doing that. And I got drunk right by myself. And I went to seminary the first day with the damnedest hangover I had ever had. And I believe, although I retained for some time after that, I retained the power to put the cork back in the bottle when I had to. As far as I'm concerned, that night, the night before my first day of seminary, is when I crossed what we call the invisible line into alcoholism. From that moment, or from that time, it was a little more than a moment, it seemed like an eternity the next morning when I was holding my head going to chapel at 7:30, feeling like my head was going to explode and thinking that everybody could look at me and tell why. But from that time, I never drank anymore for any of what might be considered by some people the right reasons. From that point onward, whenever I had an opportunity and the liquor, I never drank without getting drunk. As I say, I retained the power for a while to put the cork back in the bottle when I had to. And for a long time, I was very budget conscious, you know. After all, I wasn't working for 3 years. And so I didn't go to the liquor store with any regularity. I didn't stock it, you know, but don't invite me to your house, because I'd flat get with yours, you know. I struggled. I got through seminary all right. My grades were fine, and I thought maybe I could begin to breathe a little easier. And I transferred down to the Diocese of Eastern North Carolina, where I'd grown up, and the bishop sent me to a little church in a place called Bell Haven. Now, you just well hear about Bell Haven right now. Somebody told me one time that it sounded like a mental institution. I said, it is. Now, you don't go to Bell Haven unless you want to. There's no way you can get there accidentally. You don't go through it to go anywhere. You go there only if you want to. If you go through it, you run into the Pamlico Sound. You know, just right there. Well, I got down to Bell Haven, and I thought, surely the Lord was fooling with me, you know, that I was going to be a bishop in 5 or 10 years. It just didn't seem to be any way. The place is it's in the 19th century somewhere, where it is. In 2 years, I had about 100 communicants in the church. And I think it was 97 of them were on Medicare. Yeah. The three that weren't were my three. In 2 years, I presented 8 for confirmation. I baptized 5 and buried 23. 2 years. See? I told the bishop the Christians were losing to the lions. You know, he didn't even think it was funny. But the longer I stayed in Bellhaven, the scareder I got. I thought, my God, I'm going to be here and forgotten. You know, hell, it was 30 miles to the nearest movie theater. It wasn't anything in a little town. And I got scareder and scareder. I still controlled my drinking. You've heard of controlled drinking. Well, that little town, you know, the liquor store was right on the main street. And the prominent AAs in town all had stores across the street from the liquor store. And they watched everybody that went in there. You know, AAs met in the church. I came to know a lot about AA early, really. They met in my little church on Wednesday nights, and they liked for me to come because they liked to have a little class, you know, at the meeting. You know, so I used to go and listen. I used to send folks to AA, you know, that needed to go. Still do. And I read the grapevine. I used to get more sermon material out of that grapevine. And someday if I can find the courage, I'm going to go back and look at some of those sermons, you know. But I was familiar with AA. I controlled my drinking, but I was an alcoholic then. I never missed a service or anything of that sort, but I was an alcoholic. Because the minute I got out of trouble, the minute the restraints were down, I think all of us, you know, have a tendency to want to get away from home, you know. We get away from home, we can do things we can't do at home, you know. If you're a preacher and you're an alcoholic, yes, let me get away from home, you know. But I still controlled it. I fought it and controlled it, but it was building, I'm sure. Then they say this is a progressive disease that progresses whether we drink or not, and I believe that. I got an opportunity to go to Greensboro, North Carolina. And by this time, in my fear, I was ready to go anywhere. Now, I thought a little bit about taking this job because I was already 2 years into my master plan to become a bishop, you know. And I was getting a little old to be somebody else's assistant, but I figured I had to get out of Bellhaven some way. So I went to Greensboro, and I believe it's the best thing that ever happened to me. I went into what was no doubt the worst situation in the church, but it gave me, you've heard of justifiable excuses to drink? I had every justifiable excuse to drink, and I took them. I took them. You know, and it's the best thing that ever happened to me. I'm grateful that I went through that. You know, if it hadn't happened the way it did, I might still be struggling with this stuff. I might still be waking up sick. My drinking came to a head, and you may not think I'm an alcoholic, I don't know, but I know I'm an alcoholic. My active, uncontrolled alcoholic drinking was only a little more than a year. Friends, it was enough. And I've heard of low bottoms and high bottoms and all the rest of it, but I'll guarantee you, maybe I've just got a low tolerance for pain or something, but I suffered as much as I want to suffer from that damn stuff. I've shook and been sick all I want to. All I want to. I know what it is to need a drink. I know what it is to know that alcohol is killing you and still to need a drink. Because another drink of alcohol is the only thing that will relieve the agony that a hangover is. And we need to remember these things. I need to remember these things. You know, the human mind tends to reject pain. The way we're made is that we will forget pain. The way our mind functions, and the reason, one of the reasons that alcoholics hang on and hang on and hang on, is we remember the euphoria. We remember the glow that a water glass of whiskey provides, but we forget the pain that it causes. And I need to remember, and I don't want to ever forget the pain it caused me. The remorse, or any of the rest of it. I used to dread Sunday morning. I never could bring myself to drink before church service, no matter how bad I felt. If I just felt too bad, I had the damn flu. I just couldn't drink. It may be that if I had another job, you know, that I might have been able to carry on like that for another 2 or 3 years. But everything I did, you see, was in front of folks. My book, a leading worship service, and I'd have to hold my book up against me, you know, keep it from shaking. And sweat, my God. Used to wear, well, we do wear, you know, cassocks and stuff in church. And I found out after I got sober, I found out how the altar guild told when you cassock. Your cassock's black, you know. And I used to wonder how they could tell when it needed to be clean. And they go through and sniff under the sleeve. Hell, I never had one. It was always in the cleaners, you know. Sweat and shook and dread. I used to get up on Sunday morning at 6 o'clock. We had an early mass, early communion service, and I'd test myself whether I could hold my coffee cup in one hand. And I used to pray on Sunday, Lord, get me through today, and I promise you I'll never be in this shape again on Sunday morning. And this occurred to me recently. And it was one of those things that came over me all of a sudden. I haven't been sober so long, but I'm still grateful. I wake up in the morning and I feel good, and I'm grateful for feeling good, and I hope I never lose that. But I was in the midst of a service not long ago, and it occurred to me how good I felt, you know. And I remember, in that same sort of flash, it was a realization more than just articulating all these things in my mind. I remembered those other Sundays. And it occurred to me at that moment that I knew in the back of my mind when I said, God, get me through today and I'll never do this again. I knew that I would do it again because I didn't have any choice. I was in the rat race. I had to drink. And I used to pray. I'd kneel down in the chapel with hanging. I'd say, Lord, take this stuff off me. I knew I was an alcoholic. I thought I was admitting that I was an alcoholic. I've got some thoughts about that, too. I don't know if you want to hear them or not, but I'm here. I've heard a lot of folks say that I finally admitted to myself that I was an alcoholic. I finally accepted that that was what I was. You know, any intelligent man who admits to himself and accepts that admission that he's an alcoholic knows that the only treatment for it is total abstinence. And it's hard to give up something that has become the very center of your existence. I was a good minister. I had the flu a lot. You know, if I ever catch the flu again, I hope to hell I can think of something else to call it. Yeah. Those people in Greensboro used to say, "We love Mr. Coulter, but he has the most respiratory trouble." You know, they put a humidifier on the furnace and did everything they knew. I still had the flu. One lady said, "We like him, but he sure is nervous, you know." And I shook, and I hated myself. And I used to tell God, you know, when I'd kneel, I'd sort of shake my fist at him, and I'd say, "God, do something. You know, look what I've done for you." I mean, I gave up that high-paying job up there in Washington. And I spent all our money to go to school to become a priest, and everybody said I was a good one. And I believed it. I believed them when they said that. "Do something," I said. And it got worse, and it got worse, and I shook worse, and I hurt worse, and I hated myself more. And I shook on Sunday mornings, and I shook on Wednesday mornings, and I shook all kinds of times. And one Sunday morning, a very important Sunday morning, I couldn't make it. You know, this happens to some of us, I'm told, that, you know, important occasions somehow get clouded by the drunks. This was Easter Sunday morning. And I just couldn't have another case of the flu. Hell, I just got over one. I could not get away with another case of the flu. And I had one. I got up real early that morning, and I drank the coffee, and I took showers, and I did everything I knew to do to try to just get myself in the shape to do something. And I just couldn't do it. And I remember very well, I had a pint of vodka. I had graduated to the breathless wonder. And nobody can tell you drink when you drink vodka, you know. I had a pint, full pint of vodka in the car, and I seriously considered for the first time trying to take a drink or two of that to feel better, to make myself well enough. And I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do that. I couldn't take a drink and go into church. So I got the heat going and the little things like that around the church, and I just told the rector of the church that I couldn't make it. And I left. And I went out to a little park called the Country Park in Greensboro. And I sat there and I drank the rest of that vodka, or drank that pint of vodka. And I'm not too big a fella, and usually a pint of vodka do a lot for me when I was feeling like, but it didn't do a damn thing for me that morning. The only way I can describe to you how I felt that Easter Sunday morning 2 years ago was that I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. Now, undoubtedly, I was scared out of my mind, just like I had been ever since I had left my job and gone to seminary. But I was no longer really concerned anymore about whether I was deposed from the ministry, or I don't think at that moment I really cared whether my wife left me or stayed. I didn't care what happened. I was just sick and tired of that mess. I was sick and tired of me. And there was a man in the church, and if you haven't done this, I want you to consider it. The man in the church had told the rector of the church that he was an alcoholic. He told him this in confidence, that he was a member of AA, and that if he could ever help with any alcoholic problems, that he was available to do so. So the rector told me about this guy, and I called him. I called him, and he came to see me, and he's one of my sponsors, Joe B. in Greensboro. I don't think I realized until I got my year's chip just how much pressure Joe felt that day and the ensuing several days. But, you know, I'm sure he didn't expect to be called to be a pastor to his pastor, but Joe was an outstanding pastor to me. He told me something I already knew. He said, the only way I know for a drunk to get sober is in AA, and you know, God help me, I believe it today that the only way for an alcoholic to enjoy sobriety is in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believed it then, that was only by the grace of God that I believed it. And I said, when are we going? And he said, well, tomorrow night. And we went, and I remember it very well. I've gotten, ever since I've been in AA, precisely what I needed. It wasn't always what I wanted, but I've gotten, since I've been in AA, precisely what I've needed. By that time, the shakes were coming down a little bit. This was a Tuesday night after my fatal Sunday morning. And so I had my brightest red sports shirt on, you know, and I went trucking on down to the meeting with Joe. And folks introduced themselves, my name is John Adams. My name's Joe. That was all. I didn't want people to find out who I was, because I really didn't think I had known about AA when I'd prayed to God I'd known about AA. But I didn't think, you know, as a priest, as a minister, that I could go to AA. Just didn't see how I could do it. But I was there, and I remember it was a discussion meeting, and for me that was good. Preachers don't like to hear other folks preach, I guess. But I've always liked the discussion meetings in AA. They've always meant a whole lot to me. I remember the meeting, the step that was being discussed. It was the 11th step. And that night I picked up a chip. And I've not wanted to drink the liquor since. Now, I believe... You know, I believe as I've heard you say that God took from me the necessity, the need to drink. But I believe, you know, something else was going on too. I knew AA would work. And looking back on that first meeting, when I picked up that chip, I felt a tremendous relief. I knew AA would work, and I believe that one of the things that I did that night, without being conscious of it, or whether I was or not, was I made a decision not to decide. Remember I told you about the little book I had read, Why Am I Afraid to Tell You Who I Am? I committed myself that night to the extent that I had any control over a self to commit. But I committed myself to a program that I knew would work. I'd seen it work. And I have not wanted a drink since. God knows it. Prior to that time, I used to go by the liquor store to go home. You know, they talk about the insanity of this program. Every one of us who are alcoholics, when we took the first drink, we were sober. And I used to go by that liquor store on my way home in the evening. Should I or shouldn't I? Knowing damn well I shouldn't, you know. And I'd usually lose the battle. I'd go in and get some liquor, and I'd go home and drink it, you know. Within a matter of hours, I went by that liquor store without paying a bit of attention to it. It no longer meant anything to me. And I think that's the power of Almighty God in this program. As far as I'm concerned, that's what it is. As far as I'm concerned, when I walk in the door of AA, That's when God answered the prayers that I had been hurling up at him for months. God couldn't do anything about my problem. You know, I wanted to be a good fella and be able to have a drink with the people, you know, and be just a regular sort of a Joe. And I couldn't do that if I was an alcoholic, you see, because an alcoholic has to abstain from alcohol. And I would ask God to take this affliction off me. You know, why me was my attitude. Why me? But God couldn't do anything about what was ailing me until I got somewhere where I could tell people that it hurt and where it hurt. You know, you can break your leg and go to the doctor, and unless you tell him what's hurting, he can't fix it. And it wasn't until I could stand up among a group of people like you and say, my name is Joe Coulter and I'm an alcoholic. That's where I hurt, you know, that God could get in there. He works through you, and he works through me some too, I think. He works through us, but he's working, you know. I'm really grateful now, if that's what it took, if that pain and that self-doubt and that anger and the resentments and all the rest, if that's what it took, I'm grateful. Because I am eternally grateful for being here tonight. You know, I don't want to forget. You know, I'm dedicated to the church. For a long time after I came into AA, I'd look around and I'd see the healing. I'd see people who had no self-confidence, you know, start being able to stand up in a group and speak and to know that everybody loved them. I saw love working in AA in ways that I had never seen it work in the church, not even in that little church in which I had become a Christian. And the first few months, I was thinking, to hell with the church. Church not doing anything anyway. But I've continued to get sober, I hope. And I'm committed to the church more deeply than I ever have been before. I've recently moved to a place that, you know, I can't believe it. It's just unbelievable. I am at a place, if I had had the sense to draw up, to describe the kind of place that I quit my job and went to seminary for, it couldn't be any closer to what I'm in right now. It couldn't be any closer. There's no question in my mind but what God is working through this program in my life. But I must never forget what made this possible. However dedicated I am to the church, I must always remember that when I was falling down drunk, it was you who picked me up. I'm an alcoholic priest, and in my pastoral work, I come into contact with people with alcohol problems. I've got enough sense to know I can't solve their alcohol problems. I may be able to understand them. In fact, I hope I can, better than someone who has not suffered the pain of alcoholism. But I do what any other clergyman has to do. I take him to AA. You know, I go with him. That may be the difference. But I take him to AA. If anybody here has been sober a long time and has begun to think that somehow within himself he found the power to overcome the death, which was alcoholism, let him think again, for God's sake. The only place I could go was here. And I thank God for it. And I've gone way over, and I thank God for you. And God bless y'all. Good night.
Thank you, Joe. I enjoyed that, and I hope everybody else did. I got a question I want to ask Dr. Bacchiano why y'all don't listen. You pass the plate around here or not? No, sir? Well, that's all I wanted to know. Thank you.
Why?
I didn't know. I didn't want the man to whoop me when I got out of here. I wanted to know something.
That's your Baptist.
Yeah, well, Baptist does it, too, you know. Anybody got any announcements they want to make, or anybody got anything they want to say? If not, we'll stand and all join hands and be dismissed with the Lord's Prayer. I'm going to ask my wife to lead us. Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
I enjoyed it.